Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear from one of the local environmental advocates who will be testifying at one of the federal hearings that's happening today in Denver. It's on the Trump administration's proposal to roll back the NEPA, that's the National Environmental Policy Act. We'll hear what's at stake for local communities ahead of some rallies that are happening to coincide with the hearings later today in Denver. After that, we'll hear how the Boulder Valley School District has launched a new teaching kitchen, not just for students, but for other members of the community. After that, racism in architecture. That was the subject of a display that was recently on exhibit at the University of Colorado in Boulder. We'll hear exactly how spaces that we create can exclude so many people. We'll have a brief comment line before we go back to headlines from the BBC, and then it's time for science. And today on How on Earth, we'll hear two interviews. We'll hear the hosts explore the hype and science of stem cell medical treatments and other forms of so-called regenerative medicine. That'll be with science journalist Laura Beale. After that, the How on Earth team will discuss how we all can better grasp and decode scientific research in order to be more informed and engaged citizens. That's with Alec Whitsey, who's a science writer and a contributor to a new book called The Craft of Science Writing. As always then, on Tuesdays at 9 o'clock, we'll have Alan Watts running out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Alejandra Wilcox.
The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, filed a complaint against the city of Denver in federal court last Thursday. ICE officials say that the Denver Sheriff Department refused to turn over information about four men accused of crimes who could be subject to deportation. ICE asked the federal judge to enforce administrative subpoenas it issued to the Denver Sheriff Department in January. The Denver Post reports that the information immigration officials are seeking includes addresses, as well as identification and arrest reports on three Mexicans and a Honduran. ICE says all four men have been deported multiple times. The crimes they are charged with include sexual assault, vehicular homicide, child abuse, assault, and domestic violence. Three of the men have been released from jail, and one is still being held. While Denver did notify ICE before the three were released, there was not enough time for ICE agents to get to the jail before they were freed, according to the court filing. The attorney for Denver's Department of Safety said in a letter last week that ICE already had access to the state and federal database to which the city feeds information. The attorney pointed out that ICE had already accessed biometric data, such as fingerprints, that the Denver jail had shared when the four men were initially booked. However, in its court filing, ICE contends that the database often does not have updated address information and only basic information about criminal allegations. Denver officials accused ICE of seeking that information for political reasons and said the city would not comply unless a judge determined the orders were appropriate. A new effort is underway to tackle the cost of health care in the state. Henry Schuyler has more.
The Colorado Purchasing Alliance is currently forming a new statewide coalition of private and public employees focused on driving down the cost of private health care in the state. Currently, the hospitals and insurance companies are charged with negotiating premiums, leaving the rest of the community out of the loop. The president of the alliance, and executive director of the Colorado Business Group on Health, Robert Smith, told the Denver Post that the goal of the coalition isn't to run the insurance companies out of business, but instead to say that healthcare is way too expensive in Colorado. The hope is to grow a coalition that stretches across the entire state, to allow for all stakeholders to meet at the same table to negotiate rates. The current goal has been set at reducing premiums by 10% in 2021 and up to 20% in 2022. The alliance plans to phase in these changes over the next 3 or 4 years, allowing for hospitals and insurance companies time to adjust to more sustainable prices. For KGNU, I'm Henry Schuyler.
Denver City Council has repealed the city's 30-year ban on pit bulls. Last night's 7-4 vote was preceded by many public comments from both opponents and supporters of the ban. Now, Denver will introduce a type of probation that is meant to safely reintroduce pit bulls, who are often the subject of criticism and public debate. The repeal will replace the breed-specific ban with, quote, common-sense tactics to track pit bulls throughout the city. Among other things, the tracking includes proof a dog is microchipped and vaccinated, as well as a fee. If there are no attacks or other issues with the dogs for 3 years, the restricted license will be removed and the pit bull will be licensed just the same as any other breed. The Denver Post reports that one father who spoke at the meeting cited safety concerns and said he thought, quote, the privilege of owning a pit bull should only be granted to people who we think will be responsible owners. Another Denver resident begged the council not to visit what they called a plague upon the city. One of the repeal's co-authors, Shira Harold, praised the council's decision as a victory for Denver and dog lovers across the metropolitan area. Harold's own dog is a mixed breed with a boxy head, broad chest, and setback ears that many immediately view as characteristics of a pit bull. Harold and her boyfriend chose to live in Aurora, which has no pit bull ban, rather than risk the safety of their dog in Denver. Harold told the Denver Post that she was particularly grateful for council members who were nervous about the vote but trusted the presented data. Council President John Clark was one of those council members who said he was at first uncomfortable with the repeal but was then swayed by testimony from experts. Experts say that breed-specific laws are overly simplistic and difficult to enforce, and that there is no specific data supporting that one breed is more dangerous than another. Bite risk statistics are often inconsistent or incomplete. Additionally, pit bulls do not have special locking jaws, a common misconception. In weather today, partly cloudy, with temperatures hovering in the mid-30s and a high of 37 degrees expected. It's currently about 13 degrees here on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Alejandra Wilcox.
It is 13 minutes past 8 o'clock. A hearing takes place in Denver today to consider the Trump administration's plans to revise the country's most fundamental environmental law. The National Environmental Protection Policy Act, or NEPA, has been in place for 50 years, and it's often been described as the Magna Carta of environmental law because it requires that any major developmental project includes the federal government, involving the federal government, whether through funding or on government property, it requires that it be evaluated through environmental impact studies, and it allows impacted communities to have their voices heard. Thousands of projects currently go through the permitting process each year. Well, one of the people who will be testifying at that public hearing today in opposition to efforts to roll back NEPA will be Sam Gilchrist. He is the Western Campaign Director with the Natural Resources Defence Council.
Well, what's at stake is the limiting of people's voices in the NEPA review process. So NEPA is often the only opportunity people have to shape projects in their communities, whether that's a bridge near your home or a waterway, a freeway you drive on every day. So this allows people to review projects that impact them and how they impact our air and water. And it gives them a chance to voice their opinions and objections.
Well, I know in January, the Trump administration released a draft rule that would significantly roll back the NEPA system. And so tell us exactly what's being proposed.
What do the changes do? Well, they limit kinds of projects that need review and the scope of that review.
So give us a sense of how that might impact communities here in Colorado, because I know that you've written a blog post about certain projects in Colorado, whether it's something happening mm-hmm. in the North Fork Valley to reconstruction on State Highway 9. Give us a sense of how this might actually play out and impact communities here in Colorado.
Well, it limits voices of people in terms of their input on these projects. So you listed a couple of great examples. Another one that comes to mind is the I-70 Mountain Corridor, where, as you probably saw in my blog, the Colorado Department of Transportation engaged Coloradans in a NEPA review process that ultimately changed the plans and made them better. If anyone's driven through that corridor through Glenwood Canyon, then you could see that, you know, rerouting the Colorado River would be devastating to a place like that. And that's what the initial plans would have done is they would have actually rerouted the river and blasted through a cliff and building retaining walls, thus sort of destroying the natural beauty of that corridor.
Give us a sense as to why you think the Trump administration is trying to roll back the opportunity to have public comment and public involvement in some of these major projects.
Well, that's a good question. I believe the Trump administration is doing this to essentially limit public input. And as NEPA is the only opportunity people have to shape projects in their communities, that's concerning to me. And I think the administration, frankly, doesn't necessarily care what the public thinks on some of these major projects.
And how significant is it that there are only two public hearings on this new proposed draft rule that would roll back NEPA, one of them being here in Denver?
I think it's very significant that there are only two hearings. I mean, the NEPA itself is about public input, and while it's great to live in Denver or D.C., and be able to testify, the vast majority of people don't live in one of those two places. As you know, the speaking slots for this hearing filled up very quickly. So people are concerned about it, and I think the process as it's playing out, it is designed to limit that input.
Sam Gilchrist is the Western Campaign Director with the Natural Resources Defence Council. He's going to be one of the people testifying today at one of only two public hearings that's taking place in the light of the Trump administration's efforts to roll back the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. And Sam Gilchrist will also be taking part in some public rallies that are going to be taking place as well at the Alliance Centre that's on Wing Coop in Denver. We're going to hear from some of the other people who are participating in those public events, including leading members of frontline and Indigenous communities. They're going to be kicking off events just starting at 8:30 this morning. Then there'll be a rally in opposition to efforts to roll back NEPA that's happening at the Alliance Centre from noon till 1. And then a panel discussion and stories from frontline impacted communities that's at 4 o'clock this afternoon. But we'll have more coverage coming up just before 3 o'clock this afternoon and on tomorrow's Morning Magazine. It is 18 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, the Boulder Valley School District is working on a fundraising campaign now to create a teaching kitchen for the community. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
My name is Ann Cooper. I'm the Director of Food Services for Boulder Valley School District, and I've been here for 11 years.
And when Ann, known as Chef Ann, joined BVSD, she also joined a plan in progress for the food services team.
There was a strategic plan done in the school district. That plan ascertained that we would eventually need a centralized production facility. The central kitchen, now known as the Culinary Center, is currently being built on the same campus as the Ed Center of Boulder Valley, which will enable us to consolidate all of our production from the four places that we're cooking now. The Culinary Center will be able to produce all of our 14,000 scratch-cooked meals a day in one place and warehouse all of our food.
In addition, the plan includes a teaching kitchen to make the Culinary Center an outreach program that would include teaching culinary arts to students and the community as a whole.
Teaching kitchen is going to have multiple purposes. One is that we're partnering with CTE, Career Technical Education, here in BVSD, and we're going to be able to have culinary courses for students in the district. Additionally, those students will be able to apply for paid internships in the commercial operation of the Culinary Center. I see the teaching kitchen for CTE students as twofold. One, students may just really be interested in the culinary arts but don't believe that that's going to be their final career move. And for others, it might be a stepping stone into a high-end kitchen at the bottom level, of course, or going to culinary school. We'll also be able to have workforce development so members of the community can take classes to learn how to be chefs and cooks. We'll be able to help train the next culinarians. We'll also have courses for our families, our community. We'll have parent and student classes where they can take classes together And for some of them, it will be classes on how to cook on a budget, or how to cook more healthy food, or cook more from scratch, or cook more from the farm, and more farm to school. So we'll have a lot of different classes open to people in the community. And for others, we may have high-end classes where they're taught by our chefs or other chefs to really learn more about food in general.
One of the things that caught my eye is the team building workshops for other BVSD departments and outside organizations. Tell us a little bit about that.
So our idea about this teaching kitchen was really based on the Google teaching kitchen model. And Google has teaching kitchens at many of their campuses, including here in Boulder. And the first time I worked in one was in Mountain View. One of the things they really do is team building. So departments can come in and cook together as a team. And food is the great equalizer. So cooking together as a team and coming together as a team can be a great educational and team building opportunity. So we see this both available for our BVSD teams and also teams from the outside to come in.
Chef Ann next talked about the budget and the need to create a GoFundMe page.
School districts are always underfunded, but when it comes to buildings and operations, additionally so. So we had enough money to build the entire shell of the building. We had to actually reduce the size at one point to come in on budget. But one thing we weren't able to complete was the teaching kitchen. We need to raise about $350,000. To date, we have $180,000. We're really looking for community support. We're about to embark on a GoFundMe campaign to raise $100,000. The Whole Kids Foundation, which is part of Whole Foods, and the Lifetime Foundation, which is part of Lifetime Gyms, are matching up to $50,000 each of everything we can bring in with our GoFundMe campaign.
So that means what? $1 from supporters equals?
$3. So $1 from a supporter equals $3 to the teaching kitchen. We do have a GoFundMe campaign page, and you also can find us on BVSD Food Service page, which is food.bvsd.org. One more thing that we're really excited about being able to do in the teaching kitchen is do food literacy. And what I mean by food literacy is really an understanding of our food system. You know, in schools we teach English, math, and science, but we don't really teach everything that's going on in our food system. And frankly, food is the one thing we do from the day we're born to the day we die. So we really need to teach people about food literacy and our food system, the best, most economical, healthy, delicious ways to eat. And we'll be able to also include those classes in the teaching kitchen. The really important thing for everyone to remember is how important school food is to our students. Our students can't learn and be the best they can be academically, physically, socially, and emotionally unless they're well nourished.
So when do you think this will be completed?
The 27,000 square foot kitchen should be completed by late spring and operational for the beginning of next school year. I couldn't be more excited about this and also anxious and nervous. It's a whole new change for us. We're going to be doing almost everything differently, but a year from now, I hope we're sitting back going, this was really great. It was the best possible thing we could do.
To get more information about the School Food Project, go to food.bvsd.org. From the Arapaho Ridge High School Cafeteria, I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
A recent exhibit at the Environmental Design Center at CU explored spaces that perpetuate racism. It was titled Racism in Architecture, and the exhibit was an effort to provoke thinking about systems of oppression. KGNU's Rosanna Longo went along and spoke with some of the people involved.
My name is Ana Colon Quiñones. I'm a senior here at CU and ENBD studying architecture. And so I was an assistant to this whole about 2 years ago. We formed a research group around social justice and architecture, and kind of like what we found through our investigations led to this project.
So what is it that this project speaks to you that you said, I'm getting involved?
I guess just my experience at CU, where it's a very white, not just the school, but the whole town is very white. So kind of being in that space as a minority made me feel like I had to find a way to maybe even express that. And I know there's a lot of people like me because I've had these conversations with other students. And I think by having these sort of, or this sort of research and like an exhibit like this and having maybe even more people involved can help them like find a part in CU instead of just being like an outcast or something.
Please describe the exhibit to me.
Okay, so we're here right in the beginning of the gallery where the banners say, "In rendering space colorblind, how do we frame racism in architecture?" And this is kind of putting people in other people's shoes to see how design can affect them. So a lot of times as architects and designers and even students, we design things that maybe look cool and like where the majority of the people might think it's cool too. But a lot of times when we design things that are colorblind and we don't think about it, it can affect others, like minorities and stuff.
The space is racist. Mm-hmm. How can a space be racist? How can you explain that a space can be a racist space?
Well, one example is a lot of times spaces are designed to exclude certain people and maybe target certain people of certain demographics. So that's one way. For example, shopping centers where there's only like super expensive stores, they're excluding people with like less money. So that same idea can go with race.
When you are walking in CU, for example, and you decide to go to the library or to your favorite building, what comes to your mind? You know, do you really even feel better in one building than in another one?
Actually, yeah. So with the library, I don't really like to go there. I don't know. I think it's just like the lack of diversity in there, because if you go somewhere like the UMC where there's a lot of more diversity, it's a place where I personally feel more comfortable in. This one is an example of the prison industry pretty much. So I don't know if you knew, but in the United States, we have the largest number of incarcerated people in the world. So nowadays, there's a conversation about if architects should design more humane prisons or if they just shouldn't at all. And the thing is that when you design prisons, you're helping incarcerate even more people. So that's kind of perpetuating the problem against minorities in the United States. Whereas you can be designing other things like justice centers where it helps people be a part of a community and not just like locked up and then by the time they get out, they don't know how to function in society.
The Racism in Architecture exhibit is no longer on display at CU Boulder, but we will be putting photographs and more information, including extended interviews, online at news.kgnu.org. And thanks to Rosanna Longo for that report. It's 8:29 and it's time now for the comment line.
Hi, this is Evan Ravitz. It upsets me that KGNU is constantly asking people to volunteer for city boards and commissions. People should wonder why it takes months every year or two for the mayor and KGNU to beg for enough volunteers to fill the seats. It's because word gets out that it's a frustrating waste of time. I've had two friends on the transportation board. One, Brant Liebman, a NOAA climate scientist, told me it was 5 years of frustration. The other, Dom Nazi, a city planner, told me it was a complete waste of time, and he'd be happy to tell anyone about it. I myself have just spent 2 years on the city's campaign finance and elections working group. We put a charter amendment on the 2018 ballot so the city can offer online petitions for initiatives and referenda. It was approved overwhelmingly by voters, but city staff have done everything, legal and illegal, to obstruct the project. Everyone can see the evidence, including lots of video and audio, at tinyurl.com/petitionstory. Again, that's tinyurl.com/petitionstory. There you can find my email, and I can get you in touch with Dom Nasi. In my opinion, the boards and commissions are where the city looks for yes men and yes women who will rubber stamp what bureaucrats and the people who control City Hall want. The ones who are best at listening to people and instead doing what power wants are then groomed to run for city council, where they can show sensitivity while carrying out orders. Think twice before being used by the city as window dressing to make their top-down power structure seem democratic.
And that is the comment line.